This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. Today's episode is pre-recorded. We will not be taking any calls. Divorce is a common part of life in America. Between a quarter and a third of marriages in the U.S. end that way. But divorce can still be hard to talk about. And when couples attempt new ways of framing their separation, the response from other people can still be merciless. If you don't know what I'm referring to, just Google Gwyneth Paltrow conscious uncoupling. Vermont author Kimberly Harrington isn't going to let any of that keep her from talking about her own marriage and divorce announcement. She's an author, copywriter, and creative director who lives in Chittenden County. She's the author of the book Amateur Hour, Motherhood in Essays and Swear Words, and her work has been published in McSweeney's, The New Yorker, and The New York Times. Her new book, But You Seemed So Happy, A Marriage in Bits and Pieces, came out this week. It tells the story of her marriage through a series of essays that are both witty and deeply honest. In it, she shares how she and her husband of more than two decades decided to get divorced, but remain living under the same roof with their two children. I spoke to Kimberly Harrington by phone earlier this week. Take a listen.
Thanks for having me.
Now, your first book was about motherhood, and this one centers around divorce. You have picked two super light, fun, and personal topics to write about. What did your friends and family say when you told them that you were planning to write a book about your own marriage?
Well, it's not an exaggeration to say no one said much of anything this time around. You know, I think with the first book, first of all, it was a first book, so it was really exciting and sort of a surprising turn of events. And then with this one, because of the topic and because it was initially pitched as a divorce book, the reaction was sort of like, huh, okay, well, that's certainly a choice. And I think most people have not really known how to feel about it or what to think about it, which is completely fair because they don't know what's in it. They haven't read it. They don't know if it's going to be hurtful, which is understandable, or uncomfortable, which divorce is uncomfortable. And I'm continuously amazed at how taboo the subject is. And I knew it was a tough topic, but I've been really surprised, especially as promotion, the sort of this promotional phase of the book has ramped up, how it's really hard to get eyes on it and attention on it because it's incredible how freaked out people are about this topic.
Now, I remember when you were promoting your first book about motherhood, you said something similar in one of the interviews that I was listening to, that, you know, a lot of times people don't want to touch a book about motherhood because they see it as, you know, quote unquote, a women's issue or one with a limited audience. Did you feel the same way about pitching a book about divorce?
I mean, this is all sort of wrapped up in books that women write in general, right? So I think that there is this really biased approach to women writing about motherhood or what is seen as particularly women-focused issues, as if this doesn't affect all of humanity and isn't the reason all of humanity even exists in the first place. But what I noticed with motherhood is you kind of wipe out half of your audience right out of the gate. And with this book, it's like, wow, I really figured out how to theoretically encompass everyone, but also wipe out the entire audience at the same time. Everyone is so like, yikes, I don't know what to do about that. And what ended up happening actually over the course of writing the book, and as you know from reading it, is that it's much more about marriage and reflecting on marriage than it is about the end of a marriage. And so I started really positioning it more as a marriage book. We took that into consideration when we did the subtitle, when we were working on the subtitle as well. It's like, this shouldn't be limiting in who reads it or feels like it might apply to their life.
Now, you were born in Rhode Island, but you grew up primarily in Western Massachusetts. And as you write about it in the book, you had a really independent childhood and watched your own parents get divorced. And you wrote that you never doubted that they loved you, but you never felt particularly cared for. That phrase really stood out to me. So I'm curious how your own experiences with divorce shaped how you wanted that experience to go for your kids.
My parents' divorce became, and maybe this is the case for a lot of kids of divorce, but certainly like Gen X kids of divorce, is that you take it on perhaps a bit too much as part of your identity. That you kind of feel like well, I think I can just blame everything on this thing. You just don't have perspective on what marriage takes or long-term relationships take. So to back up, it just got stuck in my head as something I never wanted to do, and I never wanted to be a part of my life. I wanted to prove, without really realizing it at the time, I wanted to prove I could do this better and that I would do things the quote-unquote right way. And I think that hung over my head a little more than I'd like to admit, because as we worked through our marriage and tried to figure out what was going on with it and what the path ahead might be like, I think I got stuck on that a lot in terms of, but I said I wouldn't do that. You know, I said I wouldn't get divorced. I wanted to prove I could do this better. And I think it can be really challenging when you realize that you're just human, and maybe you're going to do the same things that millions of other people have done. Maybe you're not so special after all. That's sort of a tough thing to confront.
And you grew up in the 70s and 80s. You write a lot about being a Gen Xer. And this is, of course, the time in the United States where divorce rates started to rise, in part because of, you know, the women's liberation movement and women, you know, being able to make those choices for themselves for the first time. Did that social backdrop affect how you saw marriage and divorce?
For sure. You know, I don't remember feeling particularly ostracized or anything because that just seemed really common. But it's not that my parents getting divorced was like a surprise or something that I necessarily viewed as a failure, but something that our culture views as a failure. And that has not gone away. And I think that is really what shapes everyone's decisions around it, whether you want to admit it or not. No one wants to feel like they've failed at something. And what often happens is you never look back and think, I did something pretty well for 30 or 20 or 10 years, you know, you're really not allowed to feel any sort of pride in that achievement. It's just, if you didn't do this until you're dead, then it was a failure. And it seems like a bit of a high bar, let's say.
Right. I feel like if you worked at a job for 30 or 40 years and then quit or retired, you get a big party. But when it comes to marriage, you're sometimes sort of seen as, like you said, like a failure.
Yeah, and I think that's so ingrained that we don't even absorb that framing until we're actually living it. It's so automatic. It's how we view our friends, marriages, and divorces. It permeates everything. And we're never allowed to reframe it in any sort of way. And also, I feel like when people do try to reframe it, like say someone has a divorce party, you still feel like, oh, they're kind of trying too hard. Like even when you try to do something different, there's still this cynicism around it that is incredibly stubborn, and I find really surprising given how common it is.
Now, you write in the book about this really kind of weighty, poignant day when you and John, your partner, sat your two kids down and told them about your plans to separate. And you wrote about how you kind of knew that this moment was going to be one that you and them remembered potentially for your entire lives. And I'm curious, do you still remember the moment when your parents told you about their plans to separate? What was that like?
Oh, sure. It's a milestone. It's a big event. And of course, I remember, you know, all these physical details of the room and everything like that. But I also think we lose a lot of context when we say it's a huge moment in anyone's life. You know, I think that there are plenty of extremely problematic marriages and abusive marriages that it's a relief to kids when that happens. And but yeah, I remember it. But I also think it was a situation where my parents had separated multiple times leading up to that. So it also wasn't a surprise. And in the moment, whether that divorce is for good or bad, it just rearranges your emotional landscape.
I would like for you to read a passage from the new book. This is from the essay Life is Better on Weed, about you and your husband's first house in Vermont. I love the title, by the way. It's so good. And before you read it, could you describe the house for us?
So the house that we rented, to back up, we moved from Oregon to Vermont for my job. I had like 4 days to find a house for us to rent, and I actually did it. And this house, this is an old farmhouse, and to me, it was really the dream. I think when you've gone from living in a rural place to then living in a couple cities, moving to Vermont really represented space.
And about how long had you been married at this point?
We had been married for 4 or 5 years at that point.
All right. Well, whenever you're ready.
That first summer, we would sit outside after work, have a beer, and feel the heavy summer air settle all around us. More than once, the pregnant whoosh of a burner would startle us, and I'd turn to see a hot air balloon gliding up, up, up over our house, the field so close. I would look up, my chin pointing to the sky, my mouth naturally dropped open. If there is a better feeling than your life working out while you are fully aware it is working out, I'm not sure what that might be, how it could feel any more visceral and full of wonder than this. Then the sun would set and bats would pour out of our attic. It's strange we weren't just a bit more horrified by that. We would watch them exit at dusk, swoop and swerve, screech and chirp, and thank them for vacuuming up mosquitoes. Some nights we would count them, barely able to see our beards in front of our faces and watch their silhouettes. 1, 5, 15, 22, 37, 52. We'd light one cigarette off another and ignite our conversations about work in Vermont and the house and our new lives with even more alcohol, the bats still swooping and clicking. Sometimes we would take our dogs down to the river near our farmhouse and go swimming. I look back now and realize there's probably all kinds of crap in that river, literal and chemical. Odds are we were downstream from at least one farm. It's a miracle we didn't swallow E. coli. Even when we were in the water, we knew there were rusted barrels nearby, but we still had an absurd belief everything in the country was clean and right, when I knew from personal experience, it's often just a beautiful setting for burying things. I wonder now, perhaps the happiest you can ever be, when you don't know too much, when you don't know what's happening right under your feet, when you trust everything is just as it appears.
Kimberly, I absolutely love that passage. And for me, it captures this really beautiful, uncomplicated moment in your relationship where you're just sort of like two young kids at this place that you've bought somehow with your own money. It's this really special time for you. But there's also all these things lurking. There's the bats in the attic, the feces in the river. And then since, you know, we're reading a book about the dissolution of a marriage, there's also that lurking too. How do you look back on that moment now?
That's one of my favorite essays in the book. I look back at that time as just one of my favorite times in my life. You know, when we moved, a job had popped up in Vermont right when we were having a lot of financial difficulty in Oregon. And so it wasn't just that, you know, I think for some people moving here, it's sort of this long, long time dream and getting away from the city or whatever it is. And for us, it was survival. It was starting a new job, getting some stability. I think it's just that convergence of absolutely every aspect of your life working out simultaneously. And there's no way to not feel incredible about that. It was just relief and stability. And we were young, you know, it's kind of that cliche about, you know, being young and not having a ton of responsibility. We didn't have kids yet. It just was incredible. If I look at photos from that time, and certainly when I was writing the piece, I feel exactly the same way. I don't feel sad about it. It was like just one of the best times in my life.
And I think as a parent, it's a funny feeling to realize that some of the best times in your life are before parenthood, even when, you know, your kids are your most precious thing, when they bring you so much joy. But being a parent, while it's so beautiful, it can also put a lot of strain on a relationship. It can change the relationship fundamentally. But do you feel like parenthood changed you and your partner's relationship, or do you think you would have arrived at the point you're at now regardless of whether or not you had kids?
Oh, I think it changed it for sure, but I think it changes everyone's relationship. You know, it's one of those things that no one really talks about either. Or if people do talk about it, we're just all sort of narcissistic enough to think we'll be different. It's kind of like everyone who thinks their kids are only going to play with wooden toys. I mean, if your kids are only playing with wooden toys, congratulations to you. You're in the minority. So how can it not? I mean, you're introducing other human beings into your life. Like, it's crazy. I mean, if you decided to have like a neighbor move in with you, it would affect your marriage. So you just underestimate it, really. You know, I sort of feel like the narrative around to parenthood is like focused on sleep. And yeah, it's a big deal to get enough sleep, but there's just really not a lot of conversation around all the other aspects. And certainly that's changed. That was changing pre-pandemic. It certainly got blown up during the pandemic in terms of who's taking the weight on of all the labor around children and all that. I don't obviously need to sort of reiterate that for anyone who's paying attention, but I think people really sort of reflect on it really late in the game.
Well, in one of your newsletters, you wrote this line that I wrote down somewhere in my phone because I keep returning to it as a new mom myself. You wrote, "It's okay to love your children and still think motherhood is actively trying to kill you." And that really hit home for me, and I bet for a lot of other folks out there, especially during the pandemic.
I absolutely do not remember writing it, but that sounds about right.
Well, I would love to hear more about your experiences, you and your family's experiences during the pandemic, going through, you know, the process of writing a book, of, you know, rejiggering your relationship. How did being homebound for a year and a half affect you and your family?
Where John and I have always done really well is when we have a common enemy. And by that, I mean big things, you know, like losing a job or moving or someone dying. You know, I sort of feel like when there is an external force that is incredibly disruptive or threatening or upsetting, anything big, we really unite and we're a really strong team. So I feel like so many things that we might have been struggling with before in terms of dealing with our house or, you know, how socially, how is all of this going to work? It didn't matter anymore. And then we didn't really have to deal with how people reacted socially because we weren't seeing anybody. So I think that we really came together. It was an opportunity to feel really grateful that we had actually worked out our situation because I had moved into my own room, you know, so we had our whole setup. It wasn't a nightmare. And I could definitely see in the way other people reacted and with whatever state their marriages might be in that it's like, oh man, the wheels are definitely going to be coming off for a few people during this time.
Yes. I think there's a lot of folks out there who would have loved to their own room during the pandemic.
Yes, I highly recommend.
Well, while we can, you know, joke about that, the pandemic was, of course, really hard for a lot of people. Folks who, you know, decided ultimately to separate from a partner because, you know, they felt their physical safety, their mental health was being threatened, or maybe they decided to stay in the same house as a partner because they couldn't afford to live somewhere else. Have you thought about how privilege relates to your own circumstances? And what was it like trying to write a book about a separation that went, you know, for all intents and purposes, pretty well, knowing that a lot of people, you know, aren't quite as lucky?
Yeah, of course. Privilege comes into this discussion at the highest level, certainly, that we had secure housing, that I was able to work remotely the entire time, doing a freelance job that was well compensated, that I didn't need to ever worry about my physical safety or my mental health, for that matter, at least within the context of this relationship. And I've been very upfront with the fact that my story is my story and our story is our story. That is not implying that it would work for everyone or even most people. And it's certainly, you know, an unusual path that we've taken. But, you know, I would also argue that the one path, the one divorce path that is established also does not work for everyone. Mm-hmm. So there's got to be something in between these two extremes.
And are you comfortable sharing where your relationship stands now?
We're really great friends. I mean, we're still technically married, to be very clear.
Spoiler.
You know, the way we all relate to our friends is that we have a polite distance with our friends in terms of our manners, in terms of the appreciation we show our friends. I think that in a marriage, there can be, you know, snippiness and not so much appreciation for what the other person is doing. Manners can sometimes fall by the wayside. You know, we just take the other person for granted, essentially. Mm-hmm. And if we did that with our friends, we would have a lot fewer friends. And so that is really how we've evolved it, to have this true friendship where we really appreciate when the other person is going out of their way to do something for us or for the family or whatever. But what I find really interesting is when I say that to people, they're like, uh-huh. either they don't believe me, or just friendship is so, I don't want to say disrespected, but it's just not elevated the way romantic relationships are in this country. And so it's just kind of like, okay, you guys are friends. Seems boring.
Well, I can imagine some people might miss that in their own relationships. Well, one of the things that I really loved about your book was how extremely honest and open you chose to be. In one essay, for example, you talked about the experience of getting turned on during a breast exam. And it made me laugh, but I felt a little sad at the end of it, because I think, you know, as women in particular, we often laugh about our sexuality and sexual urges in order to make other people comfortable with the concept of female sexuality. And I wonder what it was like writing about that experience and being, you know, a woman with an open attitude towards your sexuality.
Yeah. Let me tell you, every breast exam since then has not been that hot.
They can't all be.
Yeah, I mean, every time I go for a follow-up, I'm like, oh my God, I cannot even believe that happened. And I wrote about it, and that's my life forever now. So writing about that and writing about anything that's in the book was creatively really satisfying and interesting, and I enjoyed the process of it, you know, more or less. Now this phase of this book actually coming out is very different. Yeah, like I don't need anyone in the line at Hannaford to come up to me and talk to me about my boob exam and like how hot I thought it was. Like, no one needs to be talking to me about that around here.
Listeners, like, take totally note.
Yeah, this is a totally different ballgame now. And so it's a conflicting feeling, I guess, is my answer. You know, there's the creative process, and then there is the weird pivot in publishing where it's now public and everyone's going to know what you wrote. Because you wrote it, you dummy. Like, the fact that I can never connect those dots is incredible to me.
Well, I can imagine that it's an interesting experience writing a memoir anywhere and having your, you know, your kind of once private stories out in the world, but particularly in Vermont, where it seems like everyone kind of knows everyone. You know, your plumber is your high school teacher's little brother, and they went to school with your kid, and this. I can imagine it feels particularly intense to have these stories out publicly in such a small state.
Yeah, I think the word you're looking for is dumb. It feels real dumb, actually, right now. I have regrets. It's a little too late, isn't it? I think that I grew up in a really small town, so this is familiar territory to me in some ways. You know, I mean, the whole reason I moved 3,000 miles away from my hometown was how I felt living in a small town. And, you know, life going full circle is not a cliche. It really happens. And I have spent a lot of time in the last week not being around. Let me put it that way. I've been going on a lot of road trips, and I've been sort of being alone in the woods. And yeah, very grateful that I'm promoting this book virtually this week.
Versus in person at bookstores and the like.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, to read a bit between the lines of your book, it does seem like you have maybe a complicated relationship with Vermont. You've lived here for more than two decades, but you write that you might not have lived here as long if not for your kids and this being their very much their home. So how do you feel about Vermont right now?
It is complicated. It really is. It's the best way to put it. You know, again, when we moved here, it felt like a dream come true on so many levels. And in a lot of ways, it continues to feel that way, certainly during the pandemic. Yet another thing to feel grateful for, to be living in a place that felt relatively safe, to feel like there was clear guidance. You know, there's a lot that's happened to renew my sense of wanting to stay. But before the pandemic, I was very much ready to leave and to go somewhere bigger. And I think that's probably just ingrained in me at this point. I think that there's constantly been this pull, you know, again, growing up in a small town, I think that there's just this pull between feeling at home in that sense and wanting to get away from it. And I suspect I'll probably ping pong between those two places for the rest of my life. And, but raising kids here, I just feel like you really can't beat it. We've been happy here as a family, but then there is, you know, am I happy here? And that's an ongoing question that I can't really do anything about in the short term anyways. You know, there's so many factors with where the world is right now, with where work is right now, with my kids still being in school, that I've learned to not look too far down the path.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that you're very focused right now, of course, on the book, on promoting it. It just came out. But I want to talk to you a little bit briefly before I let you go about your newsletter, which, you know, we get so many emails these days and it's hard to find joy in your inbox or online. But your newsletter does provide a little bright spot of joy when it appears in my inbox. And I'm curious, like, what role it plays for you in your life? What do you see the role of this kind of semi-regular bit of writing for you?
You know, authors are told to build their platform, of course, because so much of the promotion of a book now relies on authors
right.
doing a lot of that heavy lifting. But I didn't start it until after Amateur Hour came out. I was like, you know what, man, I am not going to be able to start a newsletter and have a big following by the time that book comes out. So I decided to do it anyways, even though at that point it was sort of not necessary. And it was very published very irregularly in the wake of that book. What I have really liked about doing it is that, you know, I'm pretty new to writing and pitching. I've really only been working on my own writing for 6 years. And so much has changed in that landscape. Like, I'm not great at pitching. And now that, you know, the whole market is just flooded with incredible writers from all sorts of places. And so what I've liked is just having control over what I publish and not really worrying if it lands somewhere, and also that it's going to people who actually want to hear from me is the other thing. You know, anytime, of course, it's really satisfying to get into a really prominent publication, but then you're sort of dealing with needing to fit into that slot in a certain way and, you know, comments, which I don't pay all that much attention to, but still it's just sort of you a lot goes with that, and it's really not for a whole lot of money either. It's a lot of effort and a lot of work for not a lot of money, and it's like, you know what, I'd rather do this for free and just say what I want to say and not worry about whether it does well or not, and know that it's going to an audience that actually wants to hear from me. So it's been just like a nice creative outlet that I can control, which there's, you know, there's not a lot I can control right now.
Do you still find yourself drawn to writing about your relationship or about motherhood as you did in your previous book? Or are you finding yourself wanting to move on to a new topic?
I'm definitely wanting to move on. I felt that way with the first book. What I noticed when that book came out was people wanting to categorize me as a parenting writer. So I would hear from I heard from a lot of publications when that book came out or in the wake of that book coming out about, you know, writing about parenting. And it's like, I don't really want to write about parenting. You know, this, I just happened to have started writing when I was in the thick of parenting. So that became what I wanted to write about. And then this book was the same situation. It's like, well, this is what's happening. So I want to write about that. And I think that is interesting to me in a way, because I'm not trying to define myself as someone who only is going to write about this subject or area for the rest of my life. I'm just not really interested in that, to be honest. I think that the sort of marriage and divorce space is super interesting, and I think it's going to change a lot over time, but that's not to say that that's necessarily what I'm going to keep writing about.
You close the book with a list of other books that you were inspired by or that hit you particularly hard. And I want to close this interview in the same way. What are you reading right now? What's inspiring you?
I am reading a couple of books. I actually finished one very short book that I absolutely loved, The Museum of Rain by Dave Eggers. It's part of a McSweeney subscription where they just send books. And that was one of the best things I ever signed up for, because I don't know anything about these books when they arrive. And there's something really delightful about that, about not reading reviews and just getting into it. It's a really beautiful short story. And the other one that I'm actually in the middle of that is incredible is Night Bitch by Rachel Yoder. And it is an incredible novel about, I'll say it's about motherhood, but it is about motherhood, but it's about a mother who transforms into a dog. And I'm not going to say anything else about it because it is so visceral and incredible. And I would recommend both of those books.
Enviable title too.
Yes. And an even more enviable cover for anyone who wants to look it up.
Kimberly Harrington is the author of But You Seemed So Happy, A Marriage in Bits and Pieces, which came out this week. Kimberly, thank you so much for joining Vermont Edition.
Thanks again for having me.